She is amazing. And Keiko, I think I'm going to come sit in the audience and take it away.
Thank you, Peggy. Oh, well, hi, everybody. I am powerless, over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. My name is Debbie Keiko Kenny, actually. My grandchild calls me Coco. And throughout my sobriety, I have actually had many names. My name was Debbie Shell, Debbie Kenny, Keiko Nakamura. And now my name for the last 2 years or 2.5 years has been Coco. So when I order anything, I order it under Coco. And what I learned in this program is what my name is, what I do for a living, how much money I have or don't have, who I know, how much I own, where I've been. It really doesn't matter. What matters is what I am. And what I am is powerless. Like I said before, over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. So, this is so weird. I have never in my life shared at a convention on Zoom, so I would truly like to thank Troy for bringing it to the committee and doing everything that it took. I'm learning how to do this in order for me to do it. I really appreciate it. It meant a lot to me to come to this convention, and I'm glad that I'm able to do it. And the other thing I learned in this program is to thine own self be true. And I really was planning on coming out to Wichita up until the last minute, really. It was the last minute. And they started closing things more here where I live in Massachusetts. And, you know, we're all vaccinated, and some people believe in it, some people don't. Doesn't matter to me. I do. I got vaccinated. But the thing is I live with my son-in-law and my daughter and my little grandson, which is why I moved here. And, you know, the thought of getting on an airplane and maybe just picking something up and transmitting it to him didn't appeal to me. So that's why I made the decision to stay here. And it was really difficult because I really wanted to go. But it really isn't just about me anymore. And it's really important for what I've learned in this program to honor what I believe in. And the thing I love about the program is Troy feels differently about all that than I do. Yet he took the time and listened to me. He respected how I felt and honored it. And, you know, as a result of that, things turned out this way. So I really and truly want to say that I am grateful for him. And the reason I like and I'm glad to be at this particular Cocaine Anonymous convention in Wichita, Kansas, is Cocaine Anonymous in Wichita, Kansas reminds me of what Cocaine Anonymous was like when I got sober in Phoenix, Arizona. It was small. There were a core group of people, and we all knew each other's stories. I mean, hell, back then there was only one meeting a day, if that, and we all of us went to the same meetings, and we pretty much could tell each other's story, and we knew when something was changing, and we were like this little, I don't know the word I want to say, family of people, you know, and we helped each other. So anyways, enough about that. So basically, I'm Okinawan. I was adopted. I was born in 1955, so I just turned 66. I was adopted by Americans legally when I was, I think, 6 months old. My adoption was final. My father was in the military. I had the opportunity to travel all over the world because of that. I met many different people, experienced lots of different cultures of life, and I'm very grateful about it. I loved that. I was naturalized as an American citizen on my way over to Italy when I was 5, which is really interesting because I just tried to get a real ID here in Massachusetts, even though I have a real ID in Wichita, and they would not accept my naturalization papers that I have because it's not in the system that way anymore. So they informed me that they had to go to the archives. So now I'm so old, I'm in the archives. I think that's pretty funny. I wasn't laughing then, I was pissed because I'm like, how can I have a real ID in one state and not get a real ID in another state? Whatever, I've accepted it. But anyway, so I was naturalized then. While you're listening to me, you'll notice I go off on tangents quite a bit. It isn't because I'm now a senior citizen. I've always been like this. So basically, I have 2 sisters. They're younger than I am, Judy and Sandy. My family, I always felt a part of my family. My sisters have white blonde hair, blue eyes. I always felt a part of their family. When I was a little girl, I always wanted to look like my sister. So every night I would go to bed and I would pray for God to please let me wake up in the morning and have blonde hair and blue eyes. And it never happened. But when you fast forward and I'm sober and I now have a 27-year-old daughter, she has blonde hair and blue eyes. So who figure? You pray long enough, I guess God gives you what you want later in life. Anyways, so... that didn't make sense at all. Anyways, traveled all over the world. I always felt, when I was 9, I want to say this because this is important. When I was 9 years old, I went home to play with a little girl on base. Her mom called her into the other room, and she said, get that dirty, rotten, filthy Jap out of here, and don't you ever bring her back here again. I had never experienced prejudice. I didn't even know it was prejudice. All I knew is all of a sudden I went from feeling like one of my family to being afraid that my parents would give me back. So I got fear at around 9 years old. I did not go home and tell my parents about it because I was afraid that they might send me back to Okinawa. It scared me. So, and I was raised that what adults say, you listen to what adults say and you respect them. So that's when I started to hate myself, I guess, and feel different then. You know, I was in school. I played the piano for devotion in Mobile, Alabama when we lived there. So I'm now 11 and 12 years old. Had my first boyfriend there, you know, in 7th grade. I was madly in love with him. I baked. You know, my dad got out of the service, and he was being transferred up to Akron, Ohio, and I don't want to go. It's the first time I ever lived anywhere in my life for, you know, 1 or 2 years, and I really, really didn't want to leave my friends. And I remember begging my dad, please let us stay here, but of course he didn't. And that's when all of a sudden something clicked in me, and I went from being okay with who I was to some degree, to feeling fat, ugly, and stupid. I weighed probably 110 pounds. I look like I look now, only younger. And I had A's and B's in school, so I was none of those things. But yet, that's how I felt inside. So we move up to Akron, Ohio, and I don't know how to talk about my feelings. Mind you, I've never talked about my feelings. Remember, I keep secrets about what happens to me since 9. So I start not eating. And I'm by now living on like 3 oyster crackers a day. You know, my mother's making all kinds of things for me to eat, and I'm not eating. So I have another thing, too, you guys. I'm bulimic, anorexic bulimic. So I got down to like 75 pounds. And this is the beginning of my actual drug addiction. Get down to around 75, 80 pounds. They take me to the doctor, and they came out with this new drug back then. This is in the 60s. And the doctor's going to put me on the drug. It's going to help me. And he also, by the way, put my father and my little sister on this drug too, and they were only on it for like a month, and then they got off of the drug. Not me. The name of the drug was a wonder drug, and it was called Valium. And when he put me on the drug, I took it as directed, and he said, you know, whatever it was I was taking. But then after a couple weeks, it started not working. So the doctor said, well, just split one in half and just take, you know, do that. So I did that and then just take another one. So I do not remember from 13 years old until I'm like 18 years old. My memories of that time are really like, I say it all the time, like sitting in front of a TV channel and changing the station because you can't find what you want to watch. That's how it is for me as far as memories go. I was in a singing group. I was involved in art, music. I loved it. But I don't remember. My grades went from A, Bs to Ds and Fs. I hated school. All I did is smoke pot, you know, and do drugs. And but I liked everybody. I was the person who wasn't in a clique. I liked everybody. And everybody I came to find out after I was sober many years liked me. But they remember things about me that I don't remember. So by the time I'm 18, I finally graduate from high school. I break up with my boyfriend who had been my boyfriend all through high school. It wasn't until I was sober a few years that I realized he was the class president. I mean, I didn't even remember that. So what I did is I went down to Mobile, Alabama, because I wanted to find that guy who I was madly in love with initially, because I knew I'd never be able to move on with my life. So I hooked up with him, even though he had a girlfriend, because, you know, that's how we are when we're high. We don't care. And I stole something from her, and then he asked me about it, and I, of course, lied about it. And then I was so embarrassed about it that I joined the United States Army in a blackout. I don't really remember it, but I was in the United States Army at 18 years old. And what I remember is calling my dad up because he had been military, and I thought he would be so proud of me. And I remember I called him, and I told him what I did, and it was like dead silence on the phone. So anyways, I was in the Army, joined the Army. I got an honorable discharge, I think. I never even completed basic training. So however long that was, I was in there. I have an honorable discharge because I quit taking all the Valium. I quit taking all the Valium. And what happened is because I'm bulimic, I was eating all this food all the time because you only have like short periods of time to eat it. And I was throwing up and I started throwing up blood. So they gave me an honorable discharge mainly because I was crazy. And so I came back home. That didn't work out, so I moved in with the gal, a friend of mine, who is now an attorney. And but I felt really, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this, I always felt like I was on the inside looking out, and there were big, huge glass walls that kept me from you. And it looked like everybody else in the world was happy, and everybody else had families, and everybody laughed, and everybody did all these things in life that I didn't feel a part of at all. So I wrote two suicide notes. I have one of them. I wrote one to my dad, which is the one I have, and one to my ex-boyfriend, saying how much I love them, and they'd be better off without me. And when I read that note today, I was just one lost soul. And I combined Valium. I got a whole bunch of scripts of Valium and booze because I knew that it would be fatal. And my girlfriend was going away. My roommate, God bless her, you know, she came back home because she felt something was off, and she found me in a coma. And I didn't die, you know. And I remember when I came to waking up, I remember the sunlight coming through the window. And I remember saying, I'm promising God, who I didn't even believe in by then, that I was never going to do that again. So, you know, and that's all at 18 years old. All that stuff happened all at 18 years old. So, you know, I met some guy who was 10 years older than me, married him. Out of that marriage, you know, I have a little boy. I have a little baby. I ended up leaving him when Bo was like a month old because he beat me for the first and only time. And I lived in Massachusetts, of all places, out here in Worcester. drove all the way home to Akron, Ohio with my baby. And how I felt was I felt ashamed. I felt ashamed because I had lied to my parents. I told them how happy I was, what a wonderful life I had, which my life wasn't wonderful. I was miserable, you know. So here I am back home with my little baby. They tell me, don't get a job. Just, they were going on vacation, just stay here, settle in. When we come home, you know, we'll figure things out. But because I feel guilty and ashamed, I go out and I get a job because I want them to be proud of me. Meanwhile, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm on, you know, when I was pregnant is the only time that I stopped doing drugs. When I was, I found I was pregnant 3 months old, and for whatever reason, I was still able to stop. When I was 3 months pregnant. And I never picked up again until Bo, my son, was probably about 4 months, 5 months old, because I got a job in a nightclub. Of course, anybody like me would want to get a job in a nightclub where you can drink and party with people and you get paid for it. So I didn't do anything until one day somebody just had this joint and I just took a drag off of it, and that was it. I took a drag off the joint. And then it was all over. I went from being like this breastfeeding mom to being the woman who wants to throw her child against a wall. You know, I went from having one hit off of a joint to being introduced to kilos of cocaine. So what's that? You know, I quit my job. I asked my sister to please adopt my child because I was afraid I'd harm him. I'm so grateful she did that. I want to say that is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, ever. And it is probably one of the best, it is the best thing, unselfish thing I've ever done in my life, was to ask my sister to adopt Bo. Anyways, long story short, so there I am doing cocaine. I'm off and running, have to leave my job because I can't work, you know, and that's it. Then I got to get away from all these cocaine people. All of a sudden, all these people are disappearing. So everybody's like 10 years older than me. So I'm, what am I, 25, 26 years old. So everybody's 35, 34, and all of a sudden they're disappearing. I have no idea where they're going, you know. Ends up, a couple went to treatment, a couple died, but I don't know. Then I just know I got to get away from all those people. So, you know, you fast forward now. I'm just freebasing. I'm getting away from those people. They're coming over to my house. I'm not letting them in. And I go to the bar where I used to work, nightclub, and I meet this guy. And his name was Craig Shell. And he's in the bar. He's not drinking, which really impressed me a lot. And, you know, at the end when we were leaving, because I was drinking, he wasn't drinking. He asked me, somebody was doing coke, and he said, want me to buy some? And my attitude was, no, I don't want you to buy me any coke. If I want coke, I'll buy it myself. And then I went home and I knew that I was going to marry him. So I wanted to stay away from him, you know, because I knew how screwed up I was. So he ends up calling me, you know, a month later. We were, you know, at this time I'm doing all these drugs. I'm out of my mind, crazy. Yet we're working. I'm doing volunteer work for the Cobra Connection, which was a child find agency. You know, I was doing the secretarial work. He was an investigator for it. So that's why we got together. We get together like a month later, and he comes home, and then he moves in with me. And this is how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful. So this is in 1984. He has to go to these things called Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I'm like, what's that? But because I love him, I'm going to go for him. So we go to the first meeting we ever went to. It was at Akron General Hospital. He and I waltz in, of course, late, because you always want to make an entrance. Don't you know who I am? And he's walking down the steps, and I'm walking down the steps. I have this big old hat on and my spike heels and some beautiful dress as I'm flowing down the steps thinking everybody's looking at us. And what I realized is a man and a woman came up. They walked us down into the meeting and welcomed us. So everybody's sitting at these long tables, and then we're looking around. And I'm looking around at all these people and kind of listening to what they're saying for him. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, these are great people for him. These are wonderful people for him. So that's the first AA meeting I ever went to. The last 84, I got sober in 88. So from 84 till 86, actually, because after 86, I went into one more treatment center. But I was in five or six treatment centers, five or six psych wards. Personally, I preferred the psych wards. They were more fun. You know, I could paint and play the piano. In treatment, I did things like, you know, get my big book out and underline things in the big book so people could see, you know, like highlight everything so people could look over my shoulder and know that I got it. If you ask me a question about the big book, I could give you all the answers. I could quote it for you because I knew it. Intellectually, I understood the big book. In here, I knew nothing about it. I didn't understand powerlessness. I did not understand unmanageability. I did not understand a higher power. I didn't understand any of that. I certainly wasn't honest with anybody. So I'm going in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment. Just kind of, you know, that's just my life. I was in treatment. He was in a psych ward. We were both out. He would get loaded. He would get arrested. I would go to treatment. Just that. You all know what that life is like. It's crazy. So finally, in 1986, I'm sober. 8 months. 8 months sober. I'm going to meetings. I'm chairing meetings. I'm going to all the activities. I loved you guys. Loved you people. So I'm hanging out with you. The only person I'm around who's getting loaded is my husband. He's shooting dope. They also put me on this drug to cure my bulimia. So I'm seeing a psychiatrist and I'm lying. Of course, I'm lying. I have a sponsor. Did I ever go through the steps? No, never. So I'm lying about everything. 8 months later, the pain is so great. I'm watching him die before my eyes. And I don't know how to be honest with anybody. I don't know how to tell anybody this is ripping me up. I don't know how to tell anybody, yeah, I'm taking this drug that's supposedly curing my bulimia and I'm puking my guts out as much as ever. I don't know how to tell anybody that because I'm not being honest with anybody. So I do the only thing that somebody like me can do. And I get loaded one more time. And I didn't want to get loaded, but I couldn't stand the pain. So back then there was no Google. There was these big books called Physician Desk Reference. And the book I was on, the medicine I was on said that if I was gonna have major surgery, that I needed to be off this drug because a narcotic would kill me. And of course I was doing narcotic. So I'm off of it maybe for 1-2 days, certainly not 2 weeks. And I'm in my bathroom. I have this Dilaudid, and I'm saying to myself, you can't do this. You know, it will kill you. Call somebody. All the things I heard in meetings. Pray. Well, I never prayed. Call somebody. I never called somebody. You know, so I open the door, and I say, Craig, I love you. And I slam the door, and I lock it. And I shoot up this stuff. And the whole time I'm doing it, I know I'm going to die. I don't want to die. I remember I told God I never wanted to kill myself again. And it doesn't kill me. And now I'm really pissed because I know that I'm not. I'll go out and come back. That isn't me. So the last year and a half that I was loaded, I am grateful for every single lie I told, every single dollar I stole, every single person I put a gun up to their head and was going to pull the trigger. I am grateful for every single thing I did because it got me what the big book calls beaten into a state of reasonableness. And obviously, apparently, that's what it took for me, you know. So here I am, you fast forward, I want to kill Craig. He tells me, go ahead. So I don't do it. Then I tell him I'm going to blow my brains out. He tells me, go ahead. So I don't do it. The ATF broke in our house. I told Craig for months, somebody is looking through our windows. He goes, you're just paranoid. I'm like, no, I'm not. Well, lo and behold, the ATF broke in our house. We weren't there. We were up getting methadone. So when we come back, they leave this letter. He needs to turn himself in because we have an arsenal of weapons. I'm like, we are not doing that. I break the lights, just like in the movie, you know, break all the lights out, we're crawling on the floor, out to the car. We go up to Cleveland because I tell him that's where we're going to stay. The next morning, of course, I wake up and I go get my methadone because he's still asleep. When I come back, he's gone. He's gone. I get a phone call. It's Craig. Please come to the house. Meet me at the house and get the 30-round clip. They need the 30-round clip. And I said, I'm not giving them the effing 30-round clip. You know, this is the ATF. Well, please meet me at the house. He's asking me to do this. He comes to the house, which is like 40 minutes away. I get to the house. He's shackled. The ATF, God bless these people who were in the ATF that day. They're bringing him in. He's shackled, you know, his hands behind him. And they're asking me, please get the 30-round clip. Mrs. Shell, please get the 30-round clip. I'm like, I am not going to get the 30-round clip. You broke into my house. You did this. You know, like the crazy people that we are when we're high. I'm screaming at these ATF people, and they're like, ma'am, could we please have the clip? And Craig's like, please, please get the clip. I'm like, fine. So I go and get the clip, and I give them the clip, and they say, thank you, ma'am. Then they leave. So that is what I'm like when I'm high. So that was in March. No, that was in, yeah, March, right around my birthday, March of 1988. Then Craig gets out. He's facing jail, 10 years, federal jail. He comes home. He's getting high every day. He's getting arrested every week. And I just want to get off the methadone. I want to quit shooting dope. That's why I got on the methadone. I just want to stop. Meanwhile, we get to the methadone clinic and we're late. And I freak out. I'm beating on the door because I do not want to shoot dope again. I don't want to do this anymore. And they finally opened the door and they said, look, you're late. We're closed. Come back tomorrow or whatever, the next day, whenever it was. So I'm freaking out because I know I'm going to shoot dope. I have now fear that I'm going to be dope sick. Fear. I know I'm not, but I have fear it's going to happen, right? So we go to his methadone clinic. His doctor writes me a little note. I go to the hospital. You know, please dose her. She deserves to be medicated. So they look at it. They look at me with disgust. I don't blame them. People are dying. Here I am, junkie. They look at me with disgust. They come back with all these things of pills of what I got to take. And I grab it out of the woman's hand, dump them in my hands, run over to the water fountain. And I'm like a mad dog, you know, putting them in my mouth, drinking it down. That's me. Hi. The next day, whenever it was, I got to go back to the methadone clinic. I go in. I was so angry, and that is the best thing that ever happened to me. Because in that moment, I realized that I am powerless, period. I went in and I said, you fucking own me. I'll do any fucking thing you want me to do. Best thing that ever happened to me, because that's when all the stuff I'd heard in AA meetings, you know, in all the treatment centers I was in, powerless. It means it owns me. I, you know, it doesn't matter if it's pot, Valium, cocaine, heroin. For me, it owns me once I put it into my system. And then I only wanted off. I just wanted off. So come April, and I remember the date because it was my former husband's sobriety date. He went into treatment, and I went back to AA. And how did that happen? Well, the night before, we were laying in bed, and I looked over at him, and I saw bones sticking out of his back. Now, mind you, I looked like that, too. I weighed about 75 pounds, and I weigh about 115 now. So I was really, really thin. But I couldn't see what I looked like. It's always easier for us to see what other people look like. He was dying. And I said, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm driving him around. He's ODing. You know, I'm calling 911. This is my life from, you know, I don't want to do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. I can't kill him, can't kill me. And the only thing left for me is to go back then to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I felt really, how did I feel when I was telling him this? I felt guilty. I felt like a bad friend, a bad wife, a bad human being. But I just couldn't do it. I said, I'm really sorry, but I cannot do this anymore. I have to go back to AA. So that's what happened. He went into treatment. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me say that I am so eternally grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio. I am grateful that when I got sober, that there were people, one of who was in the Big Book there, who were around me, people who were sober 43, 45 years that I hung out with, because they welcomed me, strung out on methadone, heroin, Dilaudid, and cocaine with open arms. They told me, you paid for your seat here. You belong here. You're no different than we are. I love them. I would have died without those people. So here I go to the meeting. I go, I get there. I'm like, I can't stay. So then I leave in a car. Then I drive back. Then I'm sitting there. Then I leave. Then I drive back. In Akron, you can't even get into the meeting because everybody shakes your hand and says they're powerless. So you got to shake everybody's hand just to get in the door. So I'm like this. I get in the door, sitting there. You know how you're sitting there and you look like you're like really thinking about the most creative thing you've ever thought of in your life? That kind of look. And I'm looking at like an exit sign. That's what's happening in my mind, what I really look like if everybody who's sober is like, oh my God, that's a newcomer. Anyway, so I'm sitting there looking at this exit sign. All of a sudden the meeting starts. So it's a topic meeting. Everybody gets 3 minutes to speak, then ding, 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 bell rings. So I'm sitting there listening. Then all of a sudden it's my turn. Hands sweating, heart thumping, you know, like you just want to run out of the room. And I know exactly what I said. I said, I'm powerless over alcohol. My name was Debbie Shell. I said, my name's Debbie Shell. I am strung out on methadone. I have been shooting cocaine for the last year and a half, and I need help. And I started bawling, like the crying when snot's coming out of your nose, and you're that kind of crying, and I'm sobbing, and then ding, next person. Now I'm just sitting there thinking, everybody's staring at me, and if you ever wanted to flee out of a room, you all know the feeling. So I listen to the next person, try to listen to the next person. Then all of a sudden the meeting's over. So several things happened at that meeting. All these people came up to me afterwards and they hugged me. Many people kissed me. It felt really horrible. I felt like a stiff board and they were like hugging me, so uncomfortable. And there was this man sitting next to me. And actually, Kenny, I'm looking at you, and he kind of looked like you, which looked like Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And so, mind you, I'm 33 years old, and I know his name. His name was Fred Gumbersall, and he's now deceased. But when I was sober for that eight-month period of time that I had before I went back out, which I forgot to tell you about, but whatever, he was somebody that I admired. He was the kind of person that seemed to have a peace about him. He laughed. You know, he seemed very, I'll use this word, grounded. And he was sitting next to me at this meeting, and I asked him, will you sponsor me? Because I wanted what he had. And you know what he said? He said, you know, I gotta talk to Audrey White about it. I said, okay, and I'll let you know. So, you know, I gave him my phone number, and Audrey White was a nun. She was sober 20 years at the time, which seemed an eternity to me, for God's sake. 2 days was an eternity to me. And anyways, 1 day was an eternity to me. So anyways, he got back with me, and she asked him, do you want to get in her pants? And he said, no. And she said, then you need to work with her. You have something she needs. I'm so grateful. I don't know what, honestly, I would have done if I would not have had the people God put in my life. You know, because this man made God, because I was an atheist who needed God anyways. This man made creator of the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, real for me. He had 10 acres of land. He had a pond on his land. He had a freshwater spring on his land. And he had me taste the water in this cup, and he told me, that's God. See the wind blowing through the trees? That's God. See those little chipmunks and those squirrels? That's God. So that's what I needed in order for me to connect to something. And we all get exactly who we need and what we need, the way we need it, and the way we need to hear it when we really want to get and stay sober. Okay, so then he kept like this whole journal. I said, Fred, what is that? Well, he did a written 11 step every day for 7 years. He called it his journal. I said, well, can I see what it says? He said, sure, honey. He called me Bagel, actually. Sure, Bagel, because back in those days, I loved bagels. So, in which they don't even have hardly any in Wichita, I must say. But anyways, he would open this book up, and he told, it's like the day, sunny, the temperature, and just things he wrote about what happened to him. I wanted what he had. So you know what? I kept a journal up until I got pregnant with Fallon. So she's 27. So for 7 years, I kept a journal, daily journal of everything. I want to share this. It took me years to share this in a CA meeting and an AA meeting because we are such fucking judgmental people, all of us. So, but I just want to say it took me years to share this. But, you know, I completely went through the steps like Dr. Bob did when I was very first sober, detoxing from methadone. Completely. You know why I did? Because every night I came home and I read this book as I was detoxing from methadone from April the 13th when I went back until I went into treatment May 26th. And the big book told me that if I did not go through these steps, like after I turned my will and life over, next we start out, you know, on a vigorous course of action. If I do not do this, guess what? I'm getting loaded again. And you know what? I didn't want to get loaded again. So I completely went through the steps. My first fifth step was with three other people, four, my sponsor and three other people. And what it was is it was good enough at that time because I realized some things about me that were really not so hot. And I asked God to remove them. Of course I wanted God to remove them. My first amends I made was to Craig's mother. You know why? Because my name was Debbie Lee Shell, and her initials were Doris Lee Shell. And guess what I wrote for years, every single day, $500 checks. D.L. Shell, Huntington Bank. And guess who I blamed it on? Craig. So I stole all that money, 4.5 years, from her. And I had to own it because I knew that if I didn't, I wasn't going to stay sober. And I knew she was going to wash her hands of me, maybe throw me in jail. I deserved it all. But you know what she did? She looked me straight in the eye. Oh, by the way, my amends look like this. What is it, honey? You can tell me. She's Southern. You can tell me. So when I told her, this loving and compassion look she had, it was like this. It went from this to utter disgust and then back to this. And she said, every single penny you have spent is worth it to me if you stay sober. Amen. I did not deserve that. I did not expect that. That did not make me feel like going, yay! It made me feel like I never wanted to pick up again as long as I lived. My second amends was to my sister who adopted my son. She had lots of problems with him because he lived with me. I think he lived with me until he was 11 months old. So you can only imagine living with somebody who's high. I would scream at him, yell at him. I was that kind of mom. And I went to my sister and I made amends to her. And I knew that I was never going to ever see my child, you know, see my nephew or my two nieces ever again, ever. And I understood. And I watched my sister cry as I'm making amends to her. And you know what she said to me? As long as you are sober, you are always welcome in my home. I didn't deserve that either. I didn't expect that either. Those were my hardest amends. My financial amends I had to make to this guy who owns Mart's grocery stores in Ohio because I wrote bad checks. Thank God it was way back then and I didn't have to go to jail, prison, federal prison for it. I went in with all the money, paid him, told him, you know, I need to pay you this money. This is what I did. You know, I was wrong. What can I do to make it up? Here's the money. And what he said is, do not ever come in any of my stores again. I said, okay. Thank you. You know? So anyways, okay. So that, you know, I just... Yeah, I wouldn't have stayed sober if I did not go through the steps that way. And it was the first of many times of going through the steps. I moved out to Phoenix, Arizona when I was 2.5 months sober. They told me, take God with you, go to meetings, get a sponsor. So I did. I started going to CA meetings because I could get involved. I could do stuff. AA said I couldn't. In Phoenix, unless I was a year sober, I knew I'd die. So I got involved in hospitals and institutions. Craig, Doug, and I started a whole bunch of meetings because I was passionate about it. Do you have a Cocaine Anonymous meeting here? Nope. But we have AA. We have NA. No. We need to have a Cocaine Anonymous meeting here. What if somebody comes in on cocaine and they can't relate? We need to have one, you know? And doing things like that saved my life. Doing things like that still saved my life. You know, I just moved out here to Massachusetts from Wichita. And during the move, you know, we downsized our life a lot, and our living situation a lot, gave away a lot, which I'm grateful about all of it. But just moving, the whole moving thing was a lot. We lived in a hotel for almost a month. I'm a creature of habit. I like consistency. You would have never known that when I was high, but now I'm older. And I do. I like to know I'm going to have my cup of tea over here and put my feet up on that side of my bed over there. Anyways, long story short, lived in a hotel, several hotels actually, for 3 months while we were waiting to move out here because the house sold. So while we're doing that, I'm online at this international meeting, and they have what they call a breakout room. Now, mind you, I'm sleeping 2 and 3 hours a night for 2 months. Usually, I sleep 8 hours a night, but no, I'm moving, so I'm sleeping 2 and 3 hours a night, so I'm crazy. So I'm on this meeting. There's a girl on there who wants to stay sober. I'm a woman on the meeting. Somebody else is on the meeting. They said, can you go into this breakout room? Did I want to go into the breakout room? No. Did I say no? No, I said yes. So I go into the breakout room. There's a woman in the breakout room, and she's just having a real hard time. So we're talking to her. She's sober like a little bit, and she has a cup of coffee, and it's loaded with something, like Kahlua, Tiamat, I don't know what, but booze. And she's a drug addict, but now she has this alcohol, and she realizes she's an alcoholic too, and she doesn't want to drink. So this other lady's trying to save her. And I said, look, if you need to drink it, I mean, I can't save you. I can't even save myself, for God's sake. You know, I know if you don't want to drink it, you don't have to. There's a whole other way of life, blah, 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 blah. I tell her all these different stories and all these different experiences I've had, and then get her phone number. And so for the last few months, we've been talking on and off. And she called me just, I got real sick after I moved out here, real, real sick for about 3 weeks. And she called me right before, the day before I started to feel better. And you know what she said? She left me a message and she said, I just want you to know that I was so happy I talked to you that day because I didn't take a drink. Amen. You gave me some hope. Amen. And when she called me that day, she gave me hope. She made me feel good because I was depressed. I'd been sick for three weeks. So another thing I like about this program is it just gives us love, and it gives us hope. And it doesn't matter if you're a new person or you're sober a while. You know, I used to go booing when somebody would say, how long are you sober? Well, today I woke up at 5:30, so, you know, what time did you wake up? I'm like, oh, for God's sake. You know, but the truth is, I woke up at 5:30 today. No, but the truth is that all we have is today. That's it. You know, that's what we have. Throughout my sobriety, I have had times that I have wanted to rip my hair out. I have had times that I wished I could have actually put a hitman on my former husband, but instead I called my sponsor and I called three other people and had them pray for him, and they said, we'll pray for you too, you know? And so, you know, at this time I spoke at I found this. I was given the keys to the city in Tucson, Arizona, when they had a state convention there. I was the Sunday speaker, and I brought my daughter with me. And she was on stage with me. And I saved what she wrote. It's a little piece of paper, and it has a bottle of, like, liquor. And then it has a picture of a needle, and it has, like, red X marks through it. But she was on stage the whole time I shared. You know, the thing I love about Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics, and all of them, all the 12-step programs, it's all about getting us connected to some power greater than us and then teaching us how to stay connected so we don't have to live the way we were living again. And I also want to say this, and then I'll end because my time's running out. But when I was like 25 years sober, I wanted to get loaded, man. My birthday came around in March, my, you know, belly button birthday, and I was just, my life started getting better and I just wanted to die. Kill myself. They had a birthday party for me. I'm upstairs in my bathroom crying because I couldn't talk to anybody. I went to meetings where people were sober, 10, 15 years sober longer than me, you know? And then come my sobriety birthday, this girl I'm sponsoring bought me this very significant special chip because she just couldn't get sober. And all of a sudden she was staying sober a couple months. And everybody's like, where are you going to get your chip? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, click, I don't know, click, I don't know, click, you know, because I didn't fucking care. That's where I was at, I'm telling you. I was doing all the right stuff. I'm telling you, this is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease. So, what happens? That day, everybody's still calling me. It's now May 26th. I decide I'm going to freaking Crossroads and get my chip. So I get in my car. The moment I get in my car and I start driving up there, it's only 10 minutes from where I live in Phoenix. I'm driving up there. All of a sudden, like, it's like being lifted out of me, like that thing that was on me, that thing. And I get to the meeting and my friends are there. You know, Emily gives me that chip. All the many people who were there, my friends were there, and they're all brought me flowers and stuff, and I'm like, thank you. And then I go and get my chip, and I'm like, thank you, God. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for helping me stay sober through this. because it's all about not picking up, man. So guess what? The speaker at the meeting was a guy who's now celebrating 12 years sober. And guess what he did when he was 25 years sober? Guess what he fucking did? He went back out and used. He was the speaker at the meeting. Unbelievable. Very believable. So now a funny story, and then I'm ending. I went to this meeting at Crossroads to hear the old timers in AA many years ago, and I had whooping cough and I was just getting over it. And I remember what I had on because of what happened. I had pink shorts on. Fallon, my daughter, was maybe 3 years old, Isaac's age, my grandson's age. My sponsor jams there. So here we are. I have to pee really bad, okay? And of course, we're up in the front rows. And I'm waiting, 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 because I want to hear Walt. Walt was the only oldest living member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. He was my buddy. I wanted to hear what he had to say. So I wait, wait, wait. Finally, he shares. Everybody says the Lord Prayer. Thank God. Now we can leave, okay? And all of a sudden, I coughed. Okay? Big mistake. I coughed. So this is a big meeting room. And as I'm coughing, I am peeing my pants walking down the middle aisle of this big meeting room. And my daughter is going, Mommy's peeing her pants. Mommy's peeing her pants. And Jan's going, oh, my, you're peeing your pants. And I'm like mortified that everybody's staring at me, which, by the way, if you ever want to pee your pants, do it in a meeting of Cocaine Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. Nobody will notice because everybody's into themselves. Yay! Anyway, so I go into the bathroom, and this is what to do if you ever pee your pants in public. I go into the bathroom, and I'm thinking, God, I'm glad I'm a girl, not a guy, because it will have gone straight down. Wrong. It looks like a picture of a tunnel on the outside of my pants. So thank God we're in Phoenix, and it's hot out. I take water from the sink, and I splash it on me, and that way everything's all the same color, and I can walk out to my car, and nobody notices. So that's my one funny story. Thank you so much for asking me to come here. Thank you for listening to me. And I love you all very much.
Wow. Oh, goodness. Thank you, Keiko. Love you much.